what's going on, y'all? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And join me, as always, my brud in the booth, Mr. Bill Dance, sitting across the table from me. I don't really know. Is it Scotty Martin? Isn't that another one of those deep sea fishermen or something that's out there?
I don't know. What was the guy that used to do the show called, like, Spanish Fly, where he would go fly fishing
Jose
for
tarpon? Wehebe.
Man, that guy... He looks like he's just good with the ladies. I don't know if he is, but he just looks like it,
dude,
right?
The women were swooning.
I mean, he's got a good body. He's got nice flowing hair, which instantly I'm jealous of.
Oh, yeah. He's tan. He's slim. Yeah, handsome man.
Like, if the news popped up one day that he had, you know, turned up in some kind of sex ring or something, I'd be like, oh, yeah, I totally buy that. Totally buy that. Makes complete sense to me.
For those of you who don't know, this is Kyle Filson.
Oh, how's it going, folks? Yes, I'm here. In studio. I've been jacking here. If you follow the show on Instagram, you've seen some photos probably. We got some new equipment. We've been operating on a tight budget and for no real reason. And there was a piece of equipment that we've been wanting for a long time. Never pulled the trigger. And so we bought a new preamp. And so we've been just in the studio for about 2 hours tinkering with that.
Y'all know how we are with the buttons and the knobs and how Kyle gets carried away.
Well, and the reason...
He's like that chicken that you see at the state fair that you can put money in and like play tic-tac-toe against them or whatnot. That's Kyle with all these buttons and knobs. And
the reason is because I'm an idiot and I don't know what any of these numbers and dials mean. So basically all I do is sit in there and press this, turn that till it ends up sounding the way I like it. But I couldn't tell you like what the individual things. I mean, like here's a button over here that says
stop
30-60. I don't know. I press it, it lights up. Does it sound good? I don't hear a change, no change, good change, bad change. That's the way I use it. But then we had a recording guy come over here, a friend of yours, who's a Grammy record recording artist. He's not the artist, but he's the guy that does the audio stuff. And he looked at our setup and said, yeah, it looks perfect.
Yeah.
You know, and through the editing process and listening to other podcasts, I wouldn't say we're the best, but we're definitely not the worst.
Yeah, we try real hard to make the sound right.
Anything on like Blog Talk Radio, it's hard to get through.
Yeah, the audio can be a killer.
Yeah, you know, 10 years ago, you could get away with that kind of thing. Where nowadays, in 2018, where you got big productions on podcasts now with a whole team of people and stuff. I don't really think, no matter how interesting your show is, if the audio isn't very good, I don't think people are going to stick around. They're not going to stand for it.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, with HD TV, it's kind of hard to go back to standard. You watch standard definition.
You don't watch 480 on YouTube?
And you're like, no, right? Why do they even get that option? If you, my wife, we've talked about it before, but like, I'm watching standard definition. I'm like, I can't believe I used to watch TV like this for years. Thought I had a good picture. No, you didn't. It was a terrible picture.
We hope everybody's doing good. We've been getting hammered with rain. We've got about 5 inches in the last 4 days. So the internet has been out and spotty for the last 5 days.
Yeah.
Mine at my house has been getting smashed. Like, it'll work for an hour and then it won't work for two. Then 30 minutes up, 2 hours down, back and forth. And we've had some really wild stuff.
We've got a good compared to people like in Panama City, Florida.
Yeah.
I have an uncle that lives down there. And I mean, you've seen the pictures.
Yeah.
These hurricanes, enough with the hurricanes. Are they happening more frequently? Or is it just that now that I'm an adult, most of the time, I pay more attention to it? Because when I was a kid, I don't ever remember anybody ever talking about hurricanes, but every so often. And now it seems like every season, it's bad. I mean, like, it's increasing.
Because it's guys our age now are getting to run harp.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, so they're just playing with the hurricane button.
Oh, now he's messing with
That's all it is. Yeah, I'm going to have to do a show about the harp and the weather manipulation by dudes. Crazy guys like us.
Do you think that's real?
Sure.
Or you just think it's conspiracy?
I don't know. Of course it's real.
It's like the cloud seeding and stuff. You know, people get the chemtrails and stuff. Yes, cloud seeding is a real thing. But as far as putting chemicals in the air.
You don't put a little baggie in
to keep us dumb.
Slingshot?
Well, the biggest problem with that conspiracy theory in my mind is that if the government is doing it, well, they're living in the same environment we are, so they're poisoning themselves, right? How does it make me dumber but not them?
You're asking another dumb guy. I couldn't answer that for
you. Exactly. Oh, yeah. Also, we just got back from Galveston. We went down there, an impromptu trip, and I took the brood fishing. And this is their first time saltwater fishing. So I got a private boat, Captain Matt. Big shout out to him from Bridgeport. We had like a little 28-foot center console, and we went out there, and the first thing the captain asked Caleb, because you know Caleb's the fisherman.
Yeah.
What's the biggest fish you ever caught? And he's like, well, I think I caught about a 4.5-pound catfish. And he's like, oh, yeah, we'll do better than that. So he was already excited.
And?
You should have seen the look on his face when he landed like a 26-pound bull red, redfish. I've never seen somebody that excited. I wish you could bottle that up and be able to take that. I mean, he was literally like levitating. And he was like, oh, Dad, we're mounting that. We're mounting it. I'm like, no one mounts like a 26-pound redfish. Oh, I do. I do. We're mounting it. We're mounting it.
You're like, no, no.
So
you started sending me those pictures while you were still on the boat.
Oh, yeah. So the captain was a young guy. He's like 23, 24. And he was telling, he's from a town not too far from where we live here in Weatherford. And he was telling us about how he moved down there and went to college as like 18 or 19 years old and has never gone back. The whole time, Caleb is just absorbing this. Like, he never knew that this was a possibility. And he's like, that's what I want to do. He was like, when I get out of high school, I'm moving down here. That's it. I'm just going to guide fishing
trips. You've lost him.
He doesn't even want to fish. I go, you want to go fishing this next weekend? No. Are we going to the coast? I'm like, no, I'm not interested. It's totally ruined him.
Yeah.
So now he's a saltwater fisherman.
I love it.
And he's been watching YouTube videos. The captain told him about come back down like January and we'll do some flounder fishing because they're the best eating. So now he's been on this flounder fishing kick. But we had a good time. And
he's going to be rolling gulp along the bottom, dragging flounder up in January.
the artificial bait. Yeah. Well, let's get into the news. Check this out. Our buddy Lon Strickler over at Phantoms and Monsters posted this story that was relayed to him. And it's pretty interesting about a kind of spooky imaginary friend.
Whoa.
It's written by somebody named KJ, and it says like this. It says, the story was relayed to me by a friend and coworker named Steve. He has no interest in the supernatural or the paranormal, his only passions being, in fact, technology and baseball.
That's a good passion to be into, right? Technology and baseball. That's all right.
Yeah. He says, however, he unwillingly found himself on the end of what he is certain was a ghostly encounter. Now, Steve lives in Fairlawn, New Jersey, in a 3-bedroom home with his 2 sons and daughter, and this particular story took place around 2005. Now, the first inkling that Steve and his family were not alone in the house happened late one night after his wife had went to bed and his children were all asleep. He was sitting on the couch in his living room watching television when his TV suddenly went off. Now, thinking there was a problem with the cable box, he grabbed his remote and turned it back on. Now, within minutes, it shut off again. When it happened a third time, he unplugged the TV and the box to reset everything. Now, back then, you were supposed to leave boxes unplugged for at least 30 seconds to make sure it reset correctly. So, he quickly ran to the bathroom. Now, when he came back to a very strange scene. The TV was now on with static snow on the screen, but it was still unplugged. Now, after staring at it, dumbfounded for a few seconds, it went off again, and this time it stayed off. Now, the next unexplainable occurrence happened a couple of weeks later. It was again evening, and again all his children were in bed. Now, Steve was sitting in his recliner, and his wife was on the couch doing paperwork for work. All of a sudden, he felt a hand grab his shoulder from behind, as if someone were reaching over the back of the recliner. Now, thinking that it was one of his kids, and he thought they'd probably gotten out of bed and needed something, he turned around only to see no one was there. Now, perplexed, he asked his wife if she had just seen one of the kids downstairs, but she hadn't. Still startled, he went upstairs to peek in on his kids, and he saw that they were all still tucked in and fast asleep. Now, not long after that, he was in his youngest son's room reading a bedtime story. Now, at the time, his son was 4 years old, and this particular story was about friendship. His son said that he had a friend named Jimmy, whom he liked to play with. Now, thinking he was talking about a friend at daycare, Steve asked him if he played with Jimmy at the daycare. His son responded that, no, he played with Jimmy in his bedroom. Believing that his son had his first imaginary friend, Steve turned off the light and said goodnight. Now, a couple of days later, they were again reading a bedtime story together. The subject of Jimmy came up again, and Steve asked if he was having fun with his little friend. And his son said, Jimmy's not little, Daddy. He's big. He's right over there. And he pointed to the doorway to his room. Now, even though that was slightly unnerving, Steve simply thought that his son was imagining an adult friend and didn't think much about it further. One subsequent day, Steve was talking outside with his next door neighbor who had lived in the neighborhood for years. Now, while chatting him up, he brought up that his son Hal had an imaginary friend whom he named Jimmy, but it was a bit weird because he was an older imaginary friend. Now, his neighbor then got a quizzical look on his face as Steve could see the gears turning in his head. His neighbor then informed him that a man named Jimmy had lived in Steve's house with his parents a couple of owners previous. Jimmy was a Vietnam veteran who sadly got cancer not long after returning from his tour, and he passed away not long after that. The neighbor recalled going to the funeral along with many citizens of the town, and the whole affair was extraordinarily sad. The neighbor gave a description of what Jimmy looked like, and then Steve asked his son what his imaginary friend Jimmy looked like. The only match they could make was that both descriptions included a man with brown hair, but without a picture of Jimmy, which they couldn't find, they weren't able to compare any further. So, the question is, was Steve's son Jimmy the same Jimmy who had lived in their house and was still hanging around after his death? Was he also the one who caused the shenanigans with the TV and the one who had grabbed Steve's shoulder that same night? If so, why did Jimmy visibly make himself known to Steve's son, but to no one else in the house? The writer in goes on to say that after a while, his son ceased mentioning Jimmy, and now as a teenager doesn't even recall having a friend named Jimmy. Whether this was the spirit of the young man who met his unfortunate early departure from this life or not, one thing for sure is that Steve, for at least for a small time, experienced something very unusual going on in his home. Thanks, KJ. Now, that's an interesting story, right?
Yeah.
And you, and the common thing that you find is that a lot of kids that have imaginary friends, they're kind of creepy sometimes. And then as they get older, they lose all recollection of ever having it. You know, they talked about the past lives, same kind of thing. Same scenario happens when they're real young. Some of these kids' imaginary friends, I mean, they know intricate details about them that they wouldn't otherwise know. You know, you're talking about a four-year-old kid.
But the idea of it being an adult is a real weird thing. Because most of the time, the imaginary friends, the kids are younger like them. It's like they've got a little brother or something that they want to play with or a best friend. Not like, oh, no, Jimmy's big.
Yeah, that's what kind of...
And not like an ogre big. We're not talking like, oh, yeah, Jimmy's an ogre. No, man. We're talking like Jimmy's like you, Dad.
Yeah,
right? Yeah, that's really disturbing. That's really creepy. Disturbing. Brud, you remember a while back, and I mean a while back, we had discussed in the flying, of course, we talk about pterodactyls and the thunderbirds.
Oh, yeah.
And we had covered... something that had gone down in an Arizona newspaper back in 1890. They had talked about two ranchers claimed they had shot something looked like a flying alligator. Okay, right. And then you remember I've covered again talking to the dudes in Michigan. There's been several sightings in Michigan all the way back to about 3 years ago of where they're seeing these giant birds flying through the air and all this stuff. Then I talked about the two in Nevada that said that they had seen a flying reptile. And then you remember also discussed, this has been right after that. Remember I said that there was a minister said he had seen something where he said it looked like it was Jurassic Park. And we were talking about that. Well,
we've talked about it. Why some of them that look like appear to have feathers and other ones appear to look like leathery skin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they've posted it again on Cryptozoology News, folks. Pterodactyl spotted in Texas this time. A fella claims to have seen a dinosaur bird. Now, this fellow's from San Benito. And this past Thursday said that he was at his father's farm with some friends back in 2015. Now, I told you all that because 2015 was a hot year for large animal sightings like this, for the big bird sightings.
Yeah.
Pterodactyl sightings.
I remember that.
2015. Flinchner, the MUFON investigator, L. Flinchner, was the one that was talking to this fellow from San Benito doing the investigation. And Flinchner said the fellow relayed to him that said, we looked towards the south and we witnessed a pterodactyl. Said it was coasting along a ditch. Now, what they described was something that looks like a pterosaur with about a 10-foot wingspan. And they said, now, this is the part that I like the most. They said they just looked over, they saw it. They said it appeared to have vanished into a wormhole.
Really?
Like a rip in time. Vunk, went right in.
But that makes sense in a strange way, right?
It does.
In a strange way, that makes sense.
Like we've discussed in the past. So I'm like, well, I wonder if there's been anything else going on. You know, if there's what's going on in the news. It always seems to kind of come in piles. Well, just so happens, I got lucky. Lon had this that he had shared from a fellow that named Mike LCM. So I'm not sure where he got all this, but let me tell you all this. It
Please.
Was a huge bird encounter in Germany. So, yeah, we've got a German one. Mike wrote in and said, I had a big bird experience when I was stationed in Germany. I had crawled across a field in order to establish a forward observation post. And that was a good kilometer from our tracked vehicle and well out of sight of any other human. And oddly enough, I found a nice hole to crawl into. It wasn't long before I was rewarded with opposition force activity as two M113 armored personnel carriers pulled up to about 200 meters in front of me. I observed them from my concealed position for about 30 minutes, in which they drove off completely unaware of my position. I sat there a little longer, and once I concluded no one else was coming, I packed in my night scope and crawled back to our position in the woods. Halfway through this journey, I stopped for a drink, and I don't know if I presented a target or what, but out of pitch darkness of night swooped this huge bird. Said, now the wingspan had to be between 6 and 8 foot in length, and it scared the hell out of me. I crawled back quickly and told the facts to the two tracks on the road, he said, and that's all. So I'm thinking either he saw a huge bird or a huge owl come down at him crawling. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, he's crawling, he stopped. This could be an owl, or this could be, but an owl with a wingspan, that's an 8 foot wingspan is a large wingspan for an owl.
Well, yeah, but once again, you know, when it comes to all these sightings, is the measurement correct? I mean, it's an estimation.
Very true. Yeah.
So
very true.
If it's dark out, was it maybe not 8 feet, really was 5.5 feet.
Yeah. And it's dark and you're on edge.
Scared.
Yeah, and it zooms in. You're like, what was that? Which it makes sense. An owl coming in, or, you know, but an owl at night, pitch darkness, coming in for an attack makes sense. But a pterosaur flying into a wormhole makes no sense.
Yeah, now that can't be explained. I mean, can't be explained.
That makes no sense.
All right, well, let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, we're going to be chatting with a friend of ours named Seth Breedlove. We've had him on the show before. He runs Small Town Monsters. They've made several movies like The Minerva Monster, The Beast of Whitehall, The Boggy Creek Monster, The Mothman of Point Pleasant, yes. Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, The Flatwood Monster on the Trail of Champ. And we're going to be talking to him today about his brand new movie that just came out, The Bray Road Beast. So stick with us, folks. And when we get back, we're going to be talking with Seth Breedlove. Stick around. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Everybody, we've got a real treat for you today, especially since Halloween is just around the corner. We have on the line with us filmmaker, director, possible cryptozoologist, the CEO of Small Town Monsters, Mr. Seth Breedlove, and we're going to be talking about his latest film, The Beast of Bray Road. How are you doing, Seth?
I'm awesome. How are you guys doing?
Man, we're doing great. We've had you on the show before, and a few times, I think, and I have to say, every time you release another film, they get better and better and better. You can really see how you've been honing your craft. I think from the way you lay out the movie to the shots, to the animation, it's just fantastic because there's nobody in that genre that's doing these documentaries, these films about these cryptids. And with the narration by Lyle Blackburn, he's a friend of the show. It all comes together. It was so nice to see Linda Godfrey, because we've had her on too, and she's such a sweet lady. You know, I can always picture her sitting there with her dogs and stuff. It's really cool to see how you put the film together. And I guess my first question is, of all the stories out there, what drew you in? What made you decide to do The Beast of Bray Road?
It really was just Linda in a way for me. I know the rest of my crew and Mark Matsky, who co-wrote it, they were all really excited by the, you know, the monster and that kind of stuff, and sort of the possibilities visually that would open up for, you know, direction for us to take with recreations and stuff. But I was really drawn to it because of Linda, because her approach to writing The Beast of Bray Road was so similar to my kind of outlook on subjects like this. And so I was just excited to work with her and get her involved, and then to kind of like interview her and tell her story more than anything. And that was, at the end of the day, that was like what drew me to the story was Linda Godfrey and her outlook on things. Now, after that, like after, you know, like I latched onto her sort of, I guess, personal view on this, I did start coming up with like ideas about visually how the film should look and feel and tone and stuff like that. And then when we originally like really were going to push this sort of Hammer horror film aesthetic with the whole thing, and we ended up actually pulling way back on that in the final cut, but it's still there, you know, like in the lighting of the interviews, the way the interviews are lit is very like old school horror, and the opening and closing of the movie with the book on the table, the book of the Bray Road Beast, and that's very Hammer to me. So the movie still has a little bit of that, but we were really excited to kind of get to play around with a movie that was much more classic horror than any of our other films. Mm-hmm. And this is the first one where I think we really pushed like that horror vibe more so than probably anything else that we'd done before.
Yeah, I could really tell. I love those shots with the book and everything. That was really cool.
Those were some of my, the minute it started, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to love this. I can already tell.
For those that are new to and don't have any idea who you are and what we're talking about, what the Beast of Bray Road is, can you set the setting, tell everybody about this strange beast that was seen outside where Elkhorn, Wisconsin, all the way back in the 30s. Paint the picture for everybody.
Sure. Yeah. So Elkhorn, Wisconsin is a fairly small community in Walworth County. It's a border county to Illinois in the state of Wisconsin. In the early, I guess, late 1980s and early 1990s, there were a series of sightings of some sort of upright walking, basically werewolf type creature that was seen on this road called Bray Road outside of Elkhorn. The sighting started with a girl named Doris Gibson, who was driving, on Halloween night actually, and thought she had hit a dog or something. She seemingly ran over something in the road. She stopped her car and got out of her car to check. And, what she saw on the road was this, like basically a 7 foot tall werewolf. It actually chased her. She jumped back in the car and it caught the car and actually sort of ran its claws down the back of the car and left claw marks down the trunk of the car. She took off and eventually reported it to the Walworth County Animal Control officer named John Fredrickson. And John had actually been keeping a werewolf file, or a file marked werewolf. He had taken a report. The very first report was from a girl named Lori Andreese in 1989. So he already had her report. He had Doris's, and he went on and took other reports from people who were kind of just passing through the county and, you know, people who didn't know who to report this strange animal to. But he ended up with this entire file full of, you know, reports of this creature. And at some point, after Doris's sighting, Linda Godfrey was contacted about this file, this mysterious file that this animal control officer had. And she contacted him and went on to write the first story about the Beast of Bray Road, which ran in a Delavan newspaper called The Week. Her approach to it was really kind of, I don't want to say tongue in cheek, because I think she would bristle at that, but it definitely had a little bit of a jab to it. You know, like she, you can tell very early on, she didn't quite take it very seriously. And then it's really interesting to me to sort of watch her perspective on the story change over time and become much more of a, you know, like at this point, I always say she's like 100% believer now in basically kind of all these phenomena that she's been writing about for a long time. And so she wrote about it. It went into the newspaper, and from there it kind of blossomed into this local legend that definitely gained some national notoriety. It was covered by Inside Edition and some other, you know, a lot of regional news media and stuff like that. You know, like it was, there was a terrible, terrible asylum horror movie that was done for Sci-Fi about the, you know, called The Beast of Bray Road. And from there, it's kind of in the, as far as the public eye is concerned, it's kind of died off. You know, like people probably assume that the story kind of ended in the 90s, but our movie kind of takes a look at the history that might have come before it, and sort of the cases that were taking place at the height of the Beast of Bray Road hysteria. Although, like, one thing that excited me about this movie that we hadn't done with our others was that this was very much a look at a phenomena as a whole rather than just one isolated regional case. So I wanted to do something that, you know, took a look at not just the Beast of Bray Road, but also expanded a little bit beyond that into the werewolf mythology around the world and Dog Man, you know, like where the phenomena is today. And then, you know, expand even further into the final, sort of the final chapter, the chapter is called Here to Stay. It's Lee Hample's ranch where he's recording all sorts of bizarre activity. So it was exciting for us because I think we could do something we hadn't done before and kind of show it was, you know, like with our Bigfoot movies and stuff, they're so isolated to just like the Boggy Creek Monster or the Minerva Monster. And it never really addresses the Bigfoot subject as a whole as like this is what, like one isolated case that's part of mm-hmm. a much larger story. That's never really expanded on. So in this case, we were able to expand on it and say that it looked like, you know, this sighting, this one isolated case of this bizarre dog-like creature is actually one that's, you know, part of something much larger and it's been going on for centuries around the world.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like the amount of sightings of the Dog Man or upright walking canid, it seems like they're increasing. I mean, like, I never remember hearing much about that as a child. Like, I wasn't even aware of people actually seeing these things. But it seems like now the Dog Man is really, really popular. And, you know, even this story, it almost sounds like, you know, a cheap movie you would see on Sci-Fi, like where, you know, the local sheriff has a file in his filing cabinet that says werewolf on it. And there's people, you know, actually having these sightings. There's farmers. Like I said, I think the first sighting was way back, like even in the late 30s, 36 or so.
1936. Yeah.
Yeah. So the area, it's not a new thing. It wasn't like somebody all of a sudden was on Creepypasta and they read a story about a dog man. And so they started hoaxing this. This has been going on for a long time, and it's hard to tell from the movie, but when you guys were there, you and your crew, what's the feeling of the town? Like, do they seem to really believe it, or do they think that it's a large exaggeration? Did you meet anybody that actually had some sightings that you didn't include?
Great question, actually. So it's kind of two part. I'll answer the back half of that first. We actually shot an entire interview that isn't in the film.
Director's cut.
What's that?
Director's cut. Here we come.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually or a sequel, but yeah, there's an entire interview that was shot that isn't in the final film and did include like all sorts of local mythology that it kind of was interesting, but a little too ancillary to what we were trying to do with the film. You know, like there was all this stuff about this creature called Wolf Boy, I think it was. And, you know, like there was definitely quite a few reports that were cut from the final cut of the movie. And in fact, we had shot an entire recreation that didn't make it into the final film. And part of the reason we cut the interview, there were some sound issues with it, but part of the reason we cut the final that interview was because the recreation just didn't work. You know, like we're working with these extremely low budgets that we have, and occasionally what you want to do with the story is not what kind of comes across. And, you know, like we have to be very conscious of the fact that if we put something in the film that is downright like laughable or ridiculous, it's going to destroy the whole thing. So occasionally we can get away with something like that. Like I think Flatwoods and Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, you can push the cheese factor a little bit. But something like Bray, we had to be really conscious of the fact that, you know, we were trying to be scary. We wanted it to be unnerving, and something that was just kind of silly would have stood out like a sore thumb. So that's that answer. And the other part of that is like most of the people we talk to from Elkhorn think there's let me think of how to put this actually. So there's this weird thing. We almost everyone we talked to said would kind of instantly say they didn't believe in it. But if they continued talking, you would kind of get the sense that that's not entirely true. Like, they do think something weird's going on Bury Road. They aren't surprised at all that people see strange things on that road, and they've seen and heard things for themselves on that road, which is really bizarre. Like, their initial reaction is to kind of scoff at it, but at the same time, they seem to have had their own sort of opinions about it. One of the really strange things about Elkhorn is, of all the towns we filmed in, I've never been to a town that sort of focused so little on their local legend. They want nothing to do with it as a town. There's no, obviously there's no statue like you get in Point Pleasant, but there's also no bookstores that have books like Linda's books about it. There's no t-shirts being sold. There's really nothing to indicate that Elkhorn is more known for this local legend than anything. And you know, in the movie, we interviewed one of the Bray family, who ironically was wearing a Beast of Bray Road shirt. And he said he didn't think there was any commercial value to this. And he was saying this as he had just finished telling a story about, like, how on an airplane, someone that he knew had found an article about the Beast of Bray Road in one of those local travel or airplane travel magazines. And, like, it's very bizarre. They really are shunning what is probably the biggest tourism draw they could have. I just don't understand their sort of standoffishness toward this story. But basically, the town doesn't really want anything to do with it. I do think a lot of people around the area do think something's going on there. In fact, we were filming the Bray Road sign, like the sign itself that says Bray Road. And a truck pulls up while we were out there filming. And I expected this guy to kind of like razz us or something, you know? And actually, you can kind of see this on our Facebook page. I was Facebook living when this happened. this guy pulls up and he's like, "You guys the ones shooting the movie about the Beast of Bray Road?" And I didn't know what he was going to do, so I just kind of like offhandedly said, "Maybe." And he said, "Oh yeah, it's here. I believe in it." And he wasn't joking. Like, he was dead serious. And he, you know, clearly was someone that lived on that road. So there's, you know, I think there is a local, if you can get past the initial skepticism, there is a local response that maybe there is something going on there.
Well, Seth, does that, in your opinion, does that add more validity to the sightings and all this, is when there's no monetary value? It's not like they're trying to exploit something that might have happened, you know, and so they're pumping it up. It's like they don't want it to be out there, like they're distancing themselves from it. Does that make you feel like maybe there's really more to it than what they're coming forward with?
I really do think there's more to it. I just don't know what that is. You know, like, our movie goes into some dark stuff, you know, with the occult and all that. And it was interesting when we were making it, you know, like, we had a lot of debate amongst the crew about John Frederickson's insistence that there was this satanic cult operating in the area, you know. And we did a lot of research. I did a lot of newspaper research into what Wisconsin would have been like at that time and how deep they were into, like, the satanic panic. Because I didn't, you know, like, I didn't know if John was basing his opinions on maybe succumbing somewhat to the satanic panic stuff, or if he, you know, like, genuinely knew. I knew he knew what he was talking about because he had explained to us that he'd actually had training, police training that involved, you know, knowing what to look for when it came to occult rituals. So I knew that, but I, you know, like, I did all this research and I came away from it thinking, well, maybe he really was, like, just sort of succumbing to some of the satanic panic. But then at the Mothman Festival, actually, just this past September, I bumped into Chad Lewis and Kevin Nelson. And Chad's sort of the preeminent Van Meter visitor investigator. It's a really cool story. And those dudes, Chad and Kevin, are super awesome. They're from that area, the Wisconsin area. And they actually told me that they had researched or investigated that particular angle sort of the, you know, like possible occult activity in Walworth County. And they had come away from it believing that there was a multi-generational sort of cult that operates out of Walworth County that is somehow tied to like white supremacy and all this stuff. So I came away from it thinking, okay, well, maybe there actually is something to this, like whether or not the Beast of Bray Road itself is any part of that, I'm not sure, but it does seem like there really was some sort of occult activity taking place in the area at the time. So that, you know, maybe that's part of the reason Elkhorn doesn't want anything to do with this, is that, you know, like they're afraid it's going to cast a negative light on the town, and or maybe, you know, somehow it's going to uncover this darker part of the town's history that they don't want out there.
Yeah, I could understand that completely if that's what it turns into being, is there maybe more involved. That's the reason right. it kind of feels like there might be more involved. Well, there's a part of the movie that I have to ask you about, like when we had discussed when the fella in your the Boggy Creek film, when you were interviewing him and he's down on the in the woods, like near the water himself and all that. You can really feel him reliving what was happening. And there was a picture that was posted in this film of a man that had taken the picture of a wolf track in the snow with his hand beside it. Mm-hmm. And this is bigger than any normal wolf track or dog track or anything that you can come across. Like, this is kind of abnormally mm-hmm. large for a canine. So I guess my question is, when you were interviewing him, had you seen these photos before he told you the story, or was this something he tells you the story, then he's like, hey, I got these pictures? Because I want to know, I guess, the feeling of that guy. Like, you've done enough interviews and you've done enough of these movies now that you can kind of tell when somebody wants to be in the movie, so they'll tell you what you want to hear, or when they don't. And this guy legitimately seems like he was at a loss. Like, he's like, dude, I got this. All I know is this is what I found, and this doesn't match anything that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where he was showing us all the photos that he has, all the track prints that he's got, and some of them are insanely large for a wolf print, especially a wolf that would be operating out of like Wisconsin, not mm-hmm. operating, not like it's got like a local business that it's running, but like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, like if we're talking about, so there's two guys that actually had track prints in the movie. One is Jay Bachochin, who's a local investigator, and the other is Lee. And Lee's the one that's kind of actively gathering as much of this sort of investigative material or research material as he can. He's casting every track he finds. And he's got tablefuls. The crazy thing about Lee is, like, we showed up at Lee's farm and we walked into his barn, and he's just got this like folding table set out, and it's just covered in track casts and photo albums full of game camera photos and photos he's taken himself and photos of mutilated animals on his property and that kind of thing. And the general feeling I got off of Jay and Lee is that they just want to know what's going on. Like, it's not that they're telling us a story or trying to push an agenda into the film. It's that they genuinely are looking for answers to what's taking place. I think Jay, especially, you know, as a local investigator, has been very into trying to find the truth for a very long time. But for Lee, you know, Lee comes to this as someone who's not into the paranormal. Like, Lee came to this as a guy who was a math teacher. He retires. He buys his farm. He's going to have this nice, simple, you know, retirement farm that he comes to. And then all of a sudden, before he knows it, he's dealing with, you know, like animal mutilations and strange lights in the sky and photos of like bizarre fog that comes in and eats deer and like yeah. all kinds of stuff. So, you know, like, and he's to the point where all he wants out of this is an answer as to what's taking place and how these things exist. He believes they're there. He knows they're there. He just wants to know how they're existing, how they live, and that kind of stuff. In fact, like, I think his final lines in the movie are something to that effect, like how he's entirely driven by, you know, like a search for answers.
Well, and that was my next question, is I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on the fog. That is a very disturbing thing. Something, I've got game cameras and all this, and I've gotten some odd photos, and we've had some odd photos sent to us from other people that with game camera photos, but that series was it's just unnerving. It's a really disturbing thing that there's, I mean, unless, I don't even know how you would fake it. I mean, you'd have to do a serious amount of work to make this thing work out, to make it be fake.
I don't think you could fake it. This is, I had a long conversation about this with another investigator, or like, I guess a paranormal enthusiast, about like if I thought it was a hoax or anything. And I said, I 100% believe that Lee is experiencing what he's claiming to experience. Now, what's behind it, I'm not sure. I don't think he could hoax it. And I don't think he would hoax it. It's not to say that it couldn't be some sort of natural occurrence. You know, like the thing that made the most sense to me is that it's some sort of condensation that appears on the lens that is there for 6 hours. because that's the only thing I could think of. What we're talking about here for like listeners is there's a guy who owns a farm outside of Elkhorn. He's experienced activity on his property for the last few years. He puts he doesn't anymore because now it's illegal, but he was putting out dead animals on his property almost as like bait. And at some point he had put this deer out. Like, I can't remember if it's a full size deer or, you know, a doe. I can't remember what the story was there, but it's a deer. He puts it out, at sometime the next morning, the trail cam starts going off, and over the next 6+ hours, it continues going off until he has 3,000 and some photos. And through, you know, like what, as soon as the game camera started going off, basically this mist comes in and covers the deer, and it continues going off, and then the mist goes away. And when the mist goes away, there's no deer. So it's really a strange sequence, and you kind of like rack your head as to what could take place to cause that, especially because, the mist only covers that deer. That's what I find really bizarre about it. It's like, it's not, you can see the edges of the frame where there's, you know, like you can see the background and things off to the side. And it's kind of like that mist is only really in the center of the frame, right where the deer is. And it, you know, when it goes away, there's no deer there. So you would think if someone came in and grabbed the deer, you would have at least seen them entering the frame from off the camera. So, you know, when you have 3,000 plus photos of it, there should be something coming into the frame and taking it at some point. Those are really, that's actually, that sequence is my favorite sequence in the entire movie. And it's funny because it's not driven by a recreation or being like overtly spooky. Mm-hmm. It's just that entire sequence is so weird. And I really enjoyed cutting it, I guess. It's probably my, I think that sequence works really well within the film.
Well, and I think you're 100% right. I was really appreciative of the fact that, like, when you got into this occult angle and you were, there was other things that I had learned, because everything that I had learned up until that point was, like we're talking about, was dogman sighting. I mean, that's kind of what was going on. People had seen this werewolf and that was about it. But then you kind of went to pecking on, like we said, the scarier side of it, of what would be the most frightening is it's something that might have been brought about by us, something that somebody, you know, and I don't know, it's disturbing. And the way you told the story is great. I mean, it's one of the stories, like, you can read the book, but when you, it's just like that, you watch the movie, just the way the story was told and how you shot it was great. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I can't wait to see what else you've come up with. What else? When you, like, the next films, I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
I've seen them all. I'm ready to see something keep coming. I mean, I just, like, let's keep rolling. What else have you got going on?
We actually just finished shooting our next Terror in the Skies, which we were in Southern Illinois for most of, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now. I don't know. I'm in like a different state every week right now, but we were in Southern Illinois for about 4 days filming Terror in the Skies. And we had also shot a couple of interviews for that at the Mothman Festival. So we had interviewed Ken Gerhard and Allison Jornlin. It's going to be Terror in the Skies is a look at winged cryptid reports around the state of Illinois, but it kind of focuses heavily on the, on three particular cases, the 1948 Alton, Illinois Thunderbird flap, that Lauren Coleman sort of uncovered and did a lot of research into. And then it'll cover the Lawndale flat from the 1970s. And then it'll jump ahead and cover the Chicago Mothman stuff. So we're going to take a look at those three sightings. But it's got all kinds of – we interviewed Thunderbird witnesses and a guy who saw a very large, like 20-foot-long wingspan bird that looked prehistoric. So it's going to be – I'm calling it like a spiritual sequel to the Mothman of Point Pleasant. And I was calling it that before we shot it, but then we shot it and there are some really bizarre similarities between Alton, Illinois and Point Pleasant, West Virginia, to the point where, you know, like they're both sitting on at a point where like these two or three rivers converge in towns where there are multiple floods over the years that have killed people. They're notoriously haunted, and they're both their local mascot in both towns is a flying cryptid. You know, like Alton has the Piazza bird, and Point Pleasant has the Mothman. So there's some really bizarre similarities between the two. But Lauren Coleman is in that movie. He actually flew to Illinois to be a part of it, and Troy Taylor's in it. It's going to be a really cool, very different from Bray Road. Bray Road is a horror movie in every way, and this is probably not going to be a straight up horror movie. There's definitely a couple creepy stories in it, but it's much more of a mystery and a little bit of like a wonder to it. I want to get, you know, like I love telling scary stories, but I'm also like a wide-eyed curious kid most of the time myself, and there's a little bit of that to this one.
That sounds exactly like us. So you've got, I know you don't want to let the cat out of the bag, how many more projects do you have lined up right now after this one? I mean, like, do you have a list?
We're scheduled out through at least 2021. We have announced, so Terror in the Skies, we announced, and it was already shot. We start filming Momo, the Missouri Monster in,
yes.
that'll start filming in, let me think, May. I just talked with Lyle about this. So that's going to be a really interesting movie. We're going to do a, basically like a Grindhouse style.
Yes.
Drive-in documentary. Lyle's actually kind of going to be our Peter Graves in that. And he's going to be talking directly to the camera. And kind of like walking you through the story, and it's gonna be very dirty, grimy grindhouse doc. And then we'll be following that up with the Mothman Legacy and the Bell Witch, and those should be out in 2020. Man. What I worked on today is I'm in the process of editing a 6-episode miniseries called On the Trail of Bigfoot. That is my sort of definitive look at the entire Bigfoot subject through my eyes, which I've never done. I've never done a first person perspective project before, and this is going to be narrated by me, and I'm in it a little bit. And that is, again, it's like it's taking you through the entire history of the subject, but it also is going to be interspersed with a lot of scenes of like the different researchers actually out trying to find Bigfoot. And I actually went on sort of a expedition myself and had some really weird stuff happen to me that we caught on camera. That'll be in there as well. And that'll actually be our next project that comes out on the Trail of Bigfoot. It should be out pretty early in 2019.
Man, that's
I can't wait. No, yeah. There's no way I can. We're gonna have to get you down to Texas. We're gonna have to find you a cool story to come down here and do.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, I think what we're looking at right now is like we're doing Southern Monsters following Monsters of the Midwest. We'll do Southern Monsters, and that'll be, you know, the Mothman Legacy, which is the follow up to the Mothman of Point Pleasant. And then we're gonna do the Bell Witch, and then there's one more that we're working on that we haven't announced yet. That'll be the other Southern Monsters movie. All this could be dramatically offset by the fact that we are in the very early stages of developing a Small Town Monsters series with Adam Wingard, who directed the Blair Witch remake and or the Blair Witch sequel, and he's directing King Kong versus Godzilla. We're in the very early stages of developing like a full scale small town monster series with him. So if that happens, it would potentially kind of throw off the timetable a little bit. But no matter what, we would, you know, like Small Town Monsters is always going to be an indie thing. And so that would still be around. I just am not sure how it would affect that. That could potentially affect the timetable dramatically.
Right. Well, tell people out listening how they can go about watching any of your films.
Amazon is where they stream. Vimeo On Demand and VidiSpace also have them streaming. Some of them are available on iTunes, Google Play, Hulu, Vudu, Screambox has some of them now. And or you can buy them on DVD through shop.smalltownmonsters.com or through Lyle's website. Lyle's is like Monster of Bizarro, but he's got them as well. And that if you're on social media, you can follow us on social media. I probably should mention too, like we already announced that we fund all our movies through a Kickstarter campaign that runs at the beginning of the year. So our next Kickstarter launches on February 7th, and that will actually help fund Terror in the Skies, Momo, and probably some other stuff that comes out. We actually have four projects coming out in 2019. I just haven't announced one of them yet, so we're kind of keeping that under wraps. But Kickstarter launches February 7th, so if you want to get your name in like the credits of our movies, that's how you can do it.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you for taking the time to come on the show today. It's an excellent movie. I suggest everybody go check it out as well as your other films, but this one has to be my favorite. I love the animation and everything. Thanks so much, Seth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
With Expanded Perspectives, very good chat with Seth Breedlove. I don't think I know anyone that produces such high quality movies on such a low budget. I mean, yeah. You'd think when you're watching, if you're not aware, Small Town Monsters is only like four or five guys that get together with the cameras and the mics and all that, and they storyboard these things out, and they do an incredible job. I mean, it looks as good as some very large productions. And that's what's so funny. Off air, we were talking to Seth because I think the movie was streaming in like the top five right now on Amazon for its category.
Yeah, something like that.
And he was talking about like, it's always good to see your video or your film higher than these multi-million dollar projects.
Yeah.
You know, because they're knocking these things out for like $15,000, $12,000.
Yeah.
A remarkable job. I mean, I'd like to just be curious to see how they film it, how they go about doing it, because I know nothing about film.
I love the idea of it.
Yeah.
I like it because it's indie. It's kind of like us. It's like podcasting. He's got it to that level to where he controls all of it. Him and the guys are the ones that handle all the interviews, all the everything. Now they've got Lyle in it and he's handling it. I can't wait. I'm super happy for their success. You know what I mean?
Too.
It makes me happy to see them doing well and being successful and doing it the way they want to do it, putting out what they want to put out. Because without people like that, we wouldn't have the kind of fun that we all get to have and see those things, because nobody, you have to get somebody to dedicate themselves to it.
Yeah. And what a world we live in today where people are filming themselves. They're at home using, you know, Premiere and editing all the films at home, and they're able to release it on services like Vimeo and things, Amazon. You know, like when we were kids, if you wanted to make a movie, you had to go to like film school, and then hopefully you could become a director. Yeah. I mean, you had to work your way up. nowadays, much like podcasts, the filming world is much the same. It's amazing. I like to see these people that create these things just on their own. And I like the topics, right? These cryptid topics that they're exploring. They're going all over, you know, the Beast of Whitehall, the Minerva Monster, the Mothman, you know, Bigfoot, Champ, Momo. I do a podcast with a Momo all the time. So I'm interested to see that. I'm sure Cam will have a cameo in there. But I really do like these films. I suggest you go over to Small Town Monsters. Go to the website and you can find ways to stream these videos. You can rent them on Amazon. I think it's like $3. I mean, it's Halloween, right?
What better
than to get the kids together and watch a documentary where they can really be scared that monsters are real?
I should, and I don't, and I'm going to change that. I don't own them on DVD, and I think I'm going to buy all of them in physical form.
Yeah. You need to get you a Small Town Monsters hoodie.
Dude, have you seen their new limited edition t-shirts?
No, I haven't.
Okay, the Small Town Monsters logo has like the houses and the faces. They're limited edition. They're not houses. They're pumpkins.
Oh, that's cool.
Dude, I'm like, yeah, I need one of those.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And also, you know, donate to the Kickstarter. Like you said, if you donate to the Kickstarter, you'll see your name in the credits. So how cool would it be? Years gone by, you're sitting there with your grandkids and you can go look and you have your grandpappy's names in the credits of the movie, right?
That's right.
Now's your chance. Speaking of Amazon, I was reading an article the other day and they were talking about, you know, the owner, the guy that owns.
Not personally, but I know of him.
Jeff Bezos, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you want to talk about money, folks. You're talking about a lot of money. You know, that guy's worth like $132 billion.
I'm worth like $1.50.
Right? And so the article goes on to break down how much money this guy actually makes. So they said, you're never going to believe this. You know how much on average he makes a day? A day. One day. 24 hours.
No, but this sounds awesome.
$275 million a day.
Wait, how much?
$275 million a day. They
with
said
two L's.
It's average $11.5 million per hour. He makes on average $3,182 every second, or $191,000 per minute.
Oh my!
I mean,
goodness.
That's so much money. Okay,
I would like to have that problem.
And here's another. Okay, so like $132 billion. It's such a large number, you can't wrap your head around it, right? It doesn't make sense to your brain. So if you had a dollar, Cam, and you spent a dollar every second, you know how long it would take you to spend a billion?
How long?
33 years.
Okay.
So that's one. He's got 132 of those. And he's gaining $275 million every day. I mean, when you're going to talk about balling out of control.
I want to be a baller.
I mean, he must look at people like Jay-Z and just laugh. You know? Or you see somebody like Bryce Harper or Manny Machado saying like a $400 million contract. He's like, oh, that's nice. That's 2 days, bub. 2 days.
And I don't even have to leave my house.
He literally is. I mean, that's so much money. You can't spend it fast enough.
I'd like to
it's
try.
It's like Pablo Escobar. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you can't get rid of it fast enough.
I would like to try to spend that much
who
money.
Who wouldn't? Well, okay. Say you just made the 275. You had one day of his salary. What would you do? What's the first purchase you would do?
I don't want to think about one day. I want to think about, like, let's say I could get that much money every month.
$275 million?
A month.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good.
I would take that, right? Yeah.
I think you would. Would you continue to be married?
No, are you kidding? Of course not. I would divorce my wife before I got the money, of course. I would disown my children completely. I would just, I don't want to pass that on to them.
Christmas is coming up, sir.
No, their Christmas is, they don't have to buy dad a gift. Dad's got 200.
They're like, Dad, we're rich. You know, was it Chris Rock says, I'm rich.
I'm rich. Yeah. I'm Oprah rich.
Yeah. He laughs at Oprah. He laughs at Oprah and Chris Rock at the same time.
Yeah. I would just go off and buy me a yacht and it would just be crazy. And it would actually, no. I mean, it's funny to make that joke, but.
But that kind of money would warp you, don't you think?
More money, more problems.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I'm a dummy enough. If I had the money to support my idioticies, I can't imagine. Like, I would have a jetpack and a flying car and all. Like, I wouldn't probably live long if I had that much money. You know what I mean? Like, I would probably kill myself trying to fly my flying car somewhere to the movies or something ridiculous. Like, I would have around the world. Like,
you'd be like that crazy
drone car we saw on. We did the whole. I would own one, two or three. You'd have one. I'd buy them for everybody.
I was thinking of the crazy guy on what is the movie with the girl that builds the Stargate? Contact, is that the name of it?
Yeah.
With like the rich guys up in space.
Yes, that would be me.
Also, I wanted to bring up to you, I've been getting a lot of these emails from people, listeners, fans.
No, did we win more money too from?
Oh, no, I haven't checked that. I haven't checked the spam in a while. No, this is legit. That. Have you seen the new Parkour Atlas robot by Boston Dynamics? Please tell me.
The little yellow one? Have you seen the little yellow dancing dog one? Jason Tucker from down in Florida sent that to me.
I saw that one. This one's more
scary.
We're
all dead.
You remember that Atlas one?
Yes.
Well, this one's doing parkour.
No, thank you.
I mean, it's just jumping up on boxes. Look, this is going to be a real threat. I'm not even talking about like the Terminator or something, but like, you know that they're building these things so that you can send an army of them over to whoever you want to mess up. Russia, yes. China, whatever. I mean, I think they should stop. Like, I don't really think like, what you do we think? Need that for? What do we need a parkour doing a robot for? And you know, of course, they never put the head on it because you put the skull head on it. That's the icing on the cake.
They never put a head on it.
No, but you know they're going to one day.
Because the minute you do, it's over.
Yeah. That menacing looking thing.
Yeah.
Who can jump and then deploy a robot dog.
Yeah. They have robot dogs on leashes. Robots.
It's
going to
be, what's the transformer? Soundwave where the cassette opens up in his chest and the dog comes out.
That's right.
That's basically it.
That's what's going to happen.
That's basically it.
And what did I tell you? That they were designing these robots where they could refuel their batteries off of protein?
Yeah, right.
That sounds safe. So that way they consume me.
Mm.
They kill me and consume me. I have a robotic lion that's eating me. This sounds awesome.
I mean, we better start working on some like small EMPs and stuff like that. That's why you have to defend yourself. But then they'll make it out of something that made out of lead or something that the EMP can't get through.
That's
I don't
true.
Know anything about EMPs. People are screaming at me.
Yeah.
You idiot.
You don't know anything about EMP. A lot.
No. Please. Please.
Yeah, the idea of it is terrifying.
It's ridiculous.
It really is. When you sit down, and we all make jokes about it and laugh about it, but it's not a good idea to make these things. It's, I feel like Oppenheimer. Like when you build that, like Oppenheimer knew at that moment, like, I really messed up.
I think he knew it, right? He
was like, I really messed up. And I feel like that's what Boston Dynamics and that's what all this stuff has done is now they've let the cat out of the bag. It's too late.
Yeah, once that genie's out of the bottle.
It's over. You can't put it back in.
You can't.
And now we're like, we're going down a road. We're all just riding on together waiting for this to kill us all.
Mm, how's the deer hunting been going?
Not well. It's been raining. It was, first of all, it was in the 90s and then it started raining. So
yeah.
It'll level off and all that stuff.
What do you got planned for your weekend?
Man, oh man, I don't know, man. I can't say. I have no clue. I'm leaving that whole thing open. Probably not much. We were busy all week this past weekend. I've been busy all this week. So this weekend, I'm going to try to take it easy.
I have a baseball tournament, but with all the rain and the rest of the week is predicted to rain, I doubt we play. I don't know how that's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't.
Which
understand.
I'm okay with. I'm okay with it. I think I need a weekend. Although I say that last weekend, I really didn't do anything either.
Well, yeah, you are kind of a deadbeat.
Yeah, I know. I hope the rest of you out there listening are not deadbeats. Stay careful out there. Don't
stay
work too
careful.
Hard. Stay careful.
Stay
be safe.
Careful.
Stay careful. Stay careful. However you say it. Is that not the correct nomenclature?
That's a stroke. Right
yeah,
there.
That's a stroke, right? Everybody out there, be good. Till next time, I'm your host with the most. Just back from the Gulf Coast, Kyle Filson. And with me, as always, is Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.